This doesn't even look like a hotel. It looks like some anonymous corporate structure that has no particular...
I know, well, we're right across the street from the World Trade Center, apparently. What is
this? Sort of down the street. I did a whole thing. You know your stars are? The actor?
Yeah, I love him.
I just talked to him in West Village on Jane and 4th. And I had this thing going the whole time. And then it didn't do anything.
This is like a recorder?
Well, it's a, you know, it's an iPad, but it has a digital recorder thing. I mean, it's not tape, but it does record nicely.
Really? You don't need an extra microphone piece? Where's the mic?
In there somewhere.
Wow. Impressive. How much time can you record? It just goes and goes.
It goes. It just goes. So, but I really like that piece. I was just rereading it and rereading it.
Wow.
I was thinking, gee, what can I add to this? This is good.
Yeah, I was reading it. When I read it, I was like, wow. I mean, she came over my apartment, but I was impressed by how much she took in, like, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I went to that thing that she mentioned in Toronto during the festival. But I was waiting for you to, like, come by. And
the party after?
Yeah, and you were being fashionably late or something. Right?
Oh, I don't know when I got there, but I was only there for about 15 minutes.
Because of all the rude, inappropriate comments? She mentioned some guys saying some things that were kind of... I mean, don't you kind of attract the people that are...
Oh, no, I didn't mind anyone. I mean, I just didn't know anyone there, and I could feel people about to converge on me. It was just a very panic-inducing feeling, I mean.
Yeah.
And also, maybe it's the, like, 90-year-old woman inside of me, but I cannot stand a party where there's this, like, loud music. You can't dance to it, but you also can't have a conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just like, you know, and I'm just like, as soon as I go to a place like that, I've got to get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
You can't talk, but you can't dance.
I was did exactly that very thing at that party. I said, what are people supposed to do here?
What is that? You know, I said, this is for me? You know, I mean, I understand it's business or whatever, but it's just like, oh, who likes this music? And at this volume, it makes me crazy.
It was awful house music on top of everything.
Oh, well, we took off and we went to some other party that was great.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Right. I saw the film at the Samuel Goldwyn. I didn't even see it in Toronto. I saw it at the Samuel Goldwyn thing. And I wanted to come to the thing last night. Jewish Film Festival,
yeah.
Coolidge Corner Theater. Did you go to that? Did you?
Uh-huh. Oh, my family. I have family here, so they were there.
Who? Everybody?
I have my oldest sister, and her husband came, and they brought some friends.
How many sisters?
They live here. Three sisters.
Okay.
And my mom and stepdad.
Mm-hmm.
My parents live in New Hampshire. We're from New Hampshire. So they came, and they actually, the festival gave them a room for free. So they stayed last night, and they're staying tonight.
Hmm.
That's nice. Nice visit. My mom and I stayed up till 3 o'clock in the morning. So.
Was there a party or gathering after the spring?
No.
No.
No. As a matter of fact, we did a Q&A, and it was really fun, actually. And then the royal we. It was just me. But as I was, like, walking off stage from the Q&A, I just suddenly got, like, one of those stomach aches where you just want to be in a ball on your bathroom floor, you know? So I was like, oh, you know, and I'm, like, talking to people as I'm walking out, and I just got in the car, and I was like, oh.
What was that from, you think?
I have no idea. I think it was something I ate for dinner. So, So we just came straight back to my hotel room, and it was nice.
Okay. Funny, I had a thing too. It's funny. It, 6 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, this pasta that I made for my son last night, it just, something started happening. Didn't know what to do with that.
Yeah.
But,
a rumbling within.
A rumbling. Yeah. So, who got the better of the deal? You or is it Guy Aoki? The guy?
Oh, me.
Yeah. But he did too, right? Because who's ever heard of him before that?
Yeah, no, it was good. It was nice press for him.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I don't know. I have no hard feelings for the guy. My guess is he's
he's surely not being as literal as he says when he discusses it on Bill Maher, or he doesn't really think that literally, does he? He's just doing his bit.
Well, I made the mistake of going on Bill Maher with him because...
I didn't see that. How did that go?
Not well. I mean, he brought like about 50 people in the audience. I showed up by myself, you know, and mm-hmm. and it was very stacked. It was very, and what I didn't realize, what I was naive about was mm-hmm. that this, he had no interest in having a discussion or any kind of dialogue with me. You know what I mean?
Score points,
he had way too much at stake to be open-minded or to, mm-hmm. to, you know, but his mm-hmm. big mistake is attacking comedy. I mean, it's just, there are other things. He's got an important job, you mm-hmm. know, and he's not good at it, in my opinion, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, he shouldn't be looking at comedians, you know, for...
More likely maybe films or television shows.
Yeah, I mean, why don't you look at, you know, at the time, you know, Chicago Hope, I had read a great article that he should have written, you know, mm-hmm. that he didn't, about, you know, mm-hmm. and Chicago Hope's a great show, and I'm not knocking that, but, or was a great show, but it's based on a actual hospital in Chicago, which is actually staffed with 90% Asian doctors, and that was not in any way reflected on the show. That's something that would be something good for him to take on. How about that? But, you know, instead he attacks me or Alex Borstein, who is a character actress who does an Asian old lady character that's brilliant, that he should be lauding, you know, that, and instead he attacked. It's just very short-sighted, and I have a feeling that it's most of his motivations are father issues, being, you know, it's like the way guys with overbearing mothers become cops, you know, and have some sort of like power in their lives, you know.
Mm-hmm. How long does it take you, do you think, if you suppose that through some bizarre biological freakish thing, all your material was suddenly could not be used, it was gone, you don't remember it, whatever, how long does it take you to, you know, in a ideal space to find material? Could you do a whole new act in 2 weeks if you had to? Would you need 2 months?
If I had to, yeah. I mean, whenever I have a deadline, like a roast or something, uh-huh. all of a sudden I can write, and I'm like, wow, I should be doing this every day. Writers are notoriously lazy, and I'm one of them. But
me too.
But yeah, I'm sure. You know, but
it's horrible.
But when you have a deadline, you get it done, you know?
Yeah.
And because there's no real deadline right now for my stand-up, I mean, I've got this movie coming out, and because of it, I feel like I have to write a whole new act. So I've been writing new material, but, you know, you do these 10, 15, 20-minute spots, and you have to... The new material has to be supported by old material that works.
Mm.
And that's how you write. The more new stuff you have, the more you can shed the old stuff. But it's a support system that, if you only do new stuff, which I've done before, it's very risky, and you're not necessarily giving the audience a good show if the stuff is shit. You know, you can't tell until you try it out. So you've got to support it with stuff that works until it can stand on its own, and then you can shed the old stuff, and hopefully soon, you know, before you know it, it's all new.
It's in the New Yorker article, but rather than me cribbing from that article, could you give me just an idea of what time, what year, what period you started to feel this very special, very unique, dry, sly, perverse tone in your humor coming together and starting to work, and you starting to understand what you had? And
because
everybody struggled at first, obviously.
It was a gradual process, you know. I mean, it's like when I first started, I was talking about, you know, the cliques in high school, and then mm-hmm. I lost my virginity when I was 19, and my whole act became about sex, you know. Everything was sex. It was all I thought about. And
how were the laughs? Was it just the sex alone?
They're good. I mean, it was good, you know, but I was less experienced. It was, you know, I was less consistent, you know, and it was, you know, I started out in New York. I was there for 7 years, and I'm so grateful for that, because they're the hardest crowds, you know. I mean, when I came to New York, it was like dessert. It was just so nice, you know. The audience was practically laugh on cue, and I have friends that started in LA, and when they went to New York, it's such a hard time. So, but let's see. I mean, my early around 23, 24
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Is when I started. You know, I mean, I was talking about taboo stuff sexually, and and a lot of it was not preconceived, but just a product of a family, a boundaryless family, you know.
Yeah.
And you know.
Yeah.
I
was just talking in the column the other day about how, you know, everybody is sort of conditioned. Critics are kind of conditioned. They feel they have to kind of ape the Ebert and Roper thing. You liked it or you didn't like it.
Right.
I think that with humor, I don't think it's funny. I don't think it's funny. I will never think it's funny. It isn't funny. And then there's hilariously funny. And then there's really smart funny, delightfully funny. But, and this is the hard, I don't know if I can explain this right, I didn't laugh that much at your film, but I was finding it consistently great. Maybe I'm just not a laugher, I don't know how to explain it, but you know obviously more about why people laugh and what the whole deal is.
Well, there are crowds that are laughers, and I there are some people that aren't necessarily laughing, but are like this.
Yeah.
You know that they're enjoying it. You can see it in their faces.
Yeah, okay.
And then, of course, the people don't like it at all. But, yeah. And of course, as a stand-up, you focus on them because you're out to get yourself in some way, of course. But I think it's human nature. You know, the one person who's not laughing just ruins your night. You know.
I was in near here actually. I used to live here, and eons ago, back in 70 something. 5, 6, something like that. Mort Saul doing a supper club in Revere or someplace like that. I kind of love Mort Saul. I would go up to Revere or wherever it was. It was somewhere in the North Shore, not far from Revere. And I felt so badly for him because it was raining. It was on the cold side. They had about seven groups, very sparsely attended.
Yeah.
And I felt, oh, this is awful. Where's the people, you know? And he came out and he did the show, and it was like he was playing to 10,000 people. He did not.
I love that.
You know, and I was just, oh, this is great, you know? And my respect for him, which was already high, shot up even higher.
Well, I mean, comics can really, I think, well, first of all, that's just a professional. That's just you know, my dad had the same experience as a young man, taking a date to see Sammy Davis Jr., and there were 8 people in the audience, and he did a show as if it were thousands.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And my dad always told that story, and I love that story, and it's so inspiring. It keeps you in check, you know. But I think comics can even appreciate a small crowd because it makes it all the more intimate, that can be great for comedy. I mean, a huge crowd can be a real challenge. I mean, even in the movie, but because the camera was close, you saw kind of intimate moments, but it was a large crowd, and so I was forced to be just that much bigger to accommodate it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is nice when it's a small crowd and it can be more intimate. And the key is to make that intimate. I mean, Steve Martin played Madison Square Garden and it felt intimate. I mean, there's nothing greater than that, you know? No greater feat. Huh?
Whenever that was, did you go to that show?
No, I think I was 3.
Didn't I read the New Yorker piece about you having a case for Steve Martin at one point in your life?
In love. I kept his picture from a magazine in my backpack at school.
You mean 10-year-old in love or 20-year-old in love?
High school.
Okay.
All through high school and college. I mean, in my childhood bedroom, which still my mother still lives in, it says, "I love Steve Martin" with a heart around it in pencil. It's still there. When I go home, it's still there.
What did you think of him in the latest one? Did you see it?
No, I heard it's great. Did you like it?
It's sleepy.
Boring?
We want him to be, a little Steve Martin-y, and he's playing this relatively boring guy. And so he decided to be, he was based on himself, from what I understand. But he decided to be this relatively boring, not boring, but not very exciting, not very, you know.
Well, even at his most absurd, even at his most absurd, he was subtle, which is a contrast that I love, you know.
I loved him in The Spanish Prisoner. Did you see that?
Yeah.
That was nice.
Yeah. I mean, maybe, you know, I mean, Bill Murray does that.
Yeah.
He can do nothing and is brilliant, you know. I mean,
that's how you were sitting in The Aristocrats, same pose.
Oh my God.
You had that same thing with the, remember?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Well, I didn't remember until I saw it. I mean, it was literally 15 minutes of my life.
Uh-huh. That's all they did?
I mean, they came over. I mean, let me tell you, the last thing I expected.
I'm just going to do this while we talk.
Sure.
By the way.
Was that they would even edit this thing. I mean, you do stuff like this for your friends all the time.
Right.
Oh, I'm doing this show on The Aristocrat, you know, this movie, whatever. Can we come over? And it'll just be a second. You'll do your take on it, you know. And they came over. I was subletting a place in New York. And I mean, if you watch it, I'm, you know, my hair is half up from washing my face.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the t-shirt I slept in. I'm in the skirt that I put on to walk my dog in.
Mm-hmm.
And flip-flops and no makeup. And, you know, I'm just, you know, it was one take. You know? And it's so crazy because I'm not saying, oh, that's nothing for me. I'm just saying, I saw it 3 years later, you know, when they finished it, and I was like, oh my God, that was my best work, you know? That's so sad.
I would be very happy if I were a comedian. I mean, everybody that mattered was in that film. I was really delighted with that film.
Yeah, I was too. I mean, I think I saw it, you know, when it first came out, or right before, and I was blown away.
Or
no, I saw, like, a screening for the cat, in the L.A. screening of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was blown away by the editing, first of all, just that Paul did that with all that footage. How do you not be over? I mean, that he had some sort of vision or some sort of. But I couldn't believe that they did it. And it was so. I thought it was so amazing. But, and as I fear with, you know, any movie, you know.
Mm.
If you don't see it on the early tip and the reviews come out, if they're negative, you know, that taints it. But when they're, you know, The Aristocrats get all these rave reviews, and the people who saw it subsequent to that, you know, their expectations were so high that I think they were just like, yeah, it was good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just, it can almost ruin a movie. Not that I would, you know, ever complain to get a good review, but.
It's funny.
You know what I mean?
You know what's really great about talking to you is that you're you always get the feeling if you're talking to somebody and they're basically, you know, selling a movie as you are obviously doing, and I'm going to be writing about it, but you know, you're relaxed about talking about other stuff, and there's no let's get back to the subject of my movie and me, you know. I mean,
I'm so sick of myself. I you know, someone brought up movies today, and I was like, ooh, you know, like I love talking about movies. That's but I feel like. I'm not worried about pushing the. I mean, if you're writing something, then you're gonna mention the movie, and I'd much rather have an opinion come from you or a description or what it is come from you than me. You know, just to deconstruct it like that, which I fall into because people ask me, and then you know, my ego. It's fun to do, but I always want to not do it because it ruins it, and I feel it can be, you know, identity crisis inducing. So.
That was really nicely worked out, by the way. The you know, the musical intro. That was pretty well done.
Wasn't it cool? That I collaborated with the director with that.
I mean, you must have ordered it together. And worked it out very. I mean, it looked really nicely worked out.
Oh,
I mean, it wasn't
brilliant.
Just, you know.
Oh, then when I start driving and it looks so fake, and half the audience is like, "Is that supposed to look real?" You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
But I love the rawness of it. The working with the budget we had-ness of it is, you know, I love that.
Yeah. Did you help cut, or did he only cut it?
No, he cut it in his garage, and you know, I gave notes on it, but you know. To be honest, most of them were, how can you avoid this shot that shows my thighs in this way? You know, they were vanity notes, you know. He cut it brilliantly, you know.
Why does every wire-thin Jewish girl I've ever known in my life have a thing about she's maybe a little too heavy or she needs to lose some weight.
Because
every single one thinks that, you know.
Because fat women don't deserve love.
Well, I understand that system.
Yeah, yeah, so that it's a constant horror. Yeah, right. It's not a fun way to live.
Yeah. How come, do you live, though, mainly in Los Angeles, right? And you and you
it's where my lover is.
You guys share, or?
No, I have my own place, but okay. We sleep at each other's house every night, so.
How come, this has bothered me ever since he took Bill Maher's place. He took Bill Maher's place, wasn't that right?
Yeah.
He came right in, okay. Nothing to do with Bill Maher.
Yeah, no offense.
I hate the stupid collars that he wears.
He's wearing a tie now.
He
and
is.
It looks so handsome.
Okay.
I know, because I was begging him to wear a tie.
Big elephant collar thing, you know. I just hate the way
it
looks.
I said, it's just, you're just missing a tie. You need the tie. You can't have every part of the frame and not the tie. He's like, I'll wear a tie when they move me to 11:30. You know, he's very, very,
funny.
Yeah, but then he started wearing a tie and make a big deal about it. He just was like, I decided to wear a tie and looks so handsome.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, he's just because it was cute. I liked it with the t-shirt coming through, but it's nice with the tie.
You know what? That's a real Gen X under 40 thing. You know, I mean, he didn't live through the American Gigolo, you know, Milan designer influence of sartorial. You know,
I don't understand any of the words you just said.
Well, American Gigolo, Paul Schrader, Milan being a very definitive, you know, the Armani thing, late 80s.
Right.
You know.
Oh, yeah,
and then,
okay.
Then the Gen X guys, they just started wearing these big, gross collars. And you see them at Banana Republic, and they all love them. They think, oh, yeah, that's it. You know?
Why don't you just say it? The kids today.
Well, not the kids. The kids are Gen Ys, right?
Huh?
The kids are Gen Ys. My kids.
No, I'm a kid. I'm a kid.
All right. Well, see, Gen X is 84 to... No, I'm sorry. They stopped 84. 64 to 84.
Born?
Kidding. Yeah. 64, roughly, is when boomers stopped. 64 to 84, roughly. Or am I wrong?
I have 80. No idea.
And then became Gen Y, and then there's the whatever. You know, my kids are kind of Gen Y. 17, 15.
Mm.
You guys going to have... Have you thought about having kids someday?
I'm baby crazy. I love kids, but I think I might adopt maybe in my 40s.
Mm-hmm.
But
because you have a mission to be not maternal and domestic.
I am very maternal. I mean, I love kids, you know. Mm-hmm. I love them, but I don't want to personally, not in a sad way, I don't want to pass on my genes. My whole family has depression. We all had sad childhoods, and I just can't bear to watch it. But I might adapt.
What's the next movie?
I'm doing a movie called, Rent is coming out. I'm in Rent.
I didn't know you were in Rent. I'm sorry.
I know.
I didn't know that.
I am. Oh, it's a small part. I sang two songs for my audition and got the only non-singing role.
Huh.
But okay. Well, they have the original. It's the whole original cast.
Okay. Right.
I just play.
Except for
me.
Rosario Dawson.
Yeah, Rosario Dawson.
Yeah.
But and me. I play Alexi Darling. I don't know who played her in the play.
Have you seen it yet?
No. But I was just telling the person before you is. Some guy at the gym said, you know, I saw a screening of Rent. You know, he has a client in it or something. Mm-hmm. You are the funniest thing in Rent. And I was like, oh, I am. I didn't even know I was still in it. You know, I was walking on air all the way home. And then I thought, well, it is an AIDS drama.
Yeah.
But, But I am doing a movie called School for Scoundrels coming up. Todd Phillips.
Oh, Todd Phillips.
Movie.
Yeah, I know him from way back. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Billy Bob Thornton and John Heder from Napoleon Dynamite.
And it's based upon the British thing of way, way back, right?
School for Scoundrels.
Yeah, late 50s, early 60s, a British movie, which they're probably...
Is
at least
it?
That's where they got the title.
Well, there's School for Scandal.
Oh, maybe I've got it. Okay.
See, I confused it with that. But it's... No, I think it's original.
Okay. Yeah. And who's written it?
Scott Armstrong, who wrote Old School and I think Road Trip as well.
Oh, great. Okay.
So.
All right. Well, we could go longer, but it was very nice meeting you.
I could go forever.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
And I am, but nice to meet you.